WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is exactly 2 feet taller than I am. So big deal. When he played in the NBA, he was taller than virtually anyone else on the court. But there's a lot more than his 7'1" height that set Will Chamberlain apart from other basketball players. He's one of the best shooters in the history of the game. At various times in his career, he led the league in scoring, rebounding, assists, and blocked shots. He averaged 50 points a game during one season. In 1962, he scored 100 points during one game against the Knicks. Chamberlain played for the Philadelphia 76ers and the Los Angeles Lakers, retiring from the NBA in 1974. He writes about life after basketball and about the game itself in his new memoir, A View from Above. Some athletes are lost when they retire from professional sports, but Chamberlain says his retirement didn't bring on an ego crisis.
I was one of the fortunate ones. 73-74 was my last NBA season as a player. I went on to coach one year in what was called the ABA for the San Diego Conquistadors. But being fortunate, I went straight from that to playing volleyball, professional volleyball, which had the same competition level that basketball had for me, and it gave me an outlet. So I didn't go into any kind of culture shock or after job shock, so to speak.
Do you feel like you made any mistakes in how to spend your time?
Oh, I definitely did. In fact, that's why the book is a reality. I was reflecting in 1989 on my 80s and that whole decade, and I thought maybe it was a wasted decade for me. I was a very active guy in the 50s and very active in the 60s, activist sort of guy, and playing a lot of basketball and doing many, many things. And 70 was also full for me. But the 80s kind of left me doing just on the beaches of Hawaii and playing volleyball and working on my tan, and I didn't like the way that sounded to me when I was looking back at it. And so I wanted to write down maybe what I was all about in those post-basketball years, and it evolved into this book.
When you're not involved in a sport, does your height have a different meaning?
You know, people often comment on how I feel about my height. It's hard to tell people who are not of the same stature or close to it that, this is me. This is how I was since 14, over 40 years. I don't feel any different than you may feel at being 5'1" or what have you. What happens is only when I'm around people that make me aware of how tall I am by questions or gestures or whatever, basically, it seems no different than me. You may have to duck through doorways. You're not comfortable in telephone booths and places aren't built for a 7'7" footers. But other than those little slight discomforts, I feel nothing different except when, it's expressed by others.
So you've been 7'1" since you were 14?
14, that's correct.
Was there a period where you were like growing an inch a day or something?
that's not quite an inch a day, but I went away to Virginia. My home is Philadelphia, and so we were from the Virginia area, and I went away to Virginia like when I was like 11 years old or something, and for two months during July and August. When I got back, my mother didn't want to kind of let me in. She didn't recognize who I was. I had grown about 5 inches into 2 months, so those inches did kind of come fast.
Was your height always an advantage on the court?
Well, height in most sports can be an advantage like basketball, but a lot of times it was a disadvantage because of how people viewed me. And what I mean by that is they gave a great deal of my accomplishments, they credit to being 7 foot tall. That indeed bothered me because I like to deem myself as being a good athlete, possessing some of the qualities and characteristics that would make a good athlete in speed, stamina, agility, and those kind of things. But a lot of people only saw it as a height factor. And most guys of my era, and even of this era, when you're this tall, you have to deal with those legs and arms. It's not as easy as people think it is. I was lucky. I was gifted in those areas, so physically it wasn't a barrier, but mentally it definitely was.
Well, one other question about your height: what kind of reactions do you get from people who don't know who you are, who don't figure out that you're Will Chamberlain, and they see you and you're very tall?
Well, let me say this. When I was young, you know, I was viewed as a freak. It's not a kind thing to say or a kind thing to feel. They really looked at me as young that way. But as our society has evolved and sports has become so prominent, once people see you, they immediately think, ah, basketball and dollars, you know. And I mean, you know, and so they see this great dollar machine, you understand? And even, you know, at 55, people say, hey, what team do you play for? You know, whether if they don't know me, they assume right away that I play for some professional team. And that to them is a bonus because all professional basketball players, the average one makes $1 million a year. So you have to have, you know, some real good luck going for you.
Right. If you're just joining us, my guest is Wilt Chamberlain. He's written a new book called A View from Above. Do you think that basketball has gotten taller on the whole?
You know, a lot of people say that. A lot of guys who want to equate to the fact that maybe the basketball today was better than yesteryear because the guys are bigger, faster, and stronger. Well, that's a lot of hokey pokey. Basketball players, if you compute the averages of 1960 and compute the averages of today, the 1991s, there's only about maybe an inch in difference in size, an inch going in favor of the guys of today. But if you take away some of the extremely tall guys, the Manute Bol, Philadelphia 7'7", and a few other guys 7'5", and 7'4", and you take them out of the lineup, the averages were pretty close to the same. And the guys who are the stars in the league were always about the same size, 6'6", 6'4", 6'5". So it has not changed very much as far as height's concerned.
You mentioned Manute Bol. You call Manute Bol in your book, at 7'7", a sideshow, not a player.
Yeah, well, I was not trying to be unkind to Manute Bol. What I feel here, though, is that he was hired because he is a show, which what the NBA has sort of evolved to in many, many ways, becoming more show than technical players. No one can say Manute Bol is a technically good basketball player. He takes the position, though, of one that is a good technical basketball player from ever having a chance to play because he fills that position on the roster. He can only kind of like stand there and sort of block shots, and then in the rest of the game, they stick him off in a corner somewhere. You know, so I have to think that he has been displayed and used as a sideshow, and I don't find that very, very favorable.
So from what you've been saying, you don't think the basket should be raised in basketball?
No, I don't know how much the average person really truly knows about a trajectory and about the game of basketball. But if you raise the basket, you would only make the game more applicable for the taller player because the balls would come off the rim a lot higher, so therefore they would have the advantage even more so. What you do is you widen the courts and you do some of the things that they're now doing by allowing the lanes to be more wide open so the quicker and more agile players get a chance to move around better. That's the best way to maybe to, you know, if you think that you need to legislate a little bit against the tall guy, which they did as I was coming along, they changed rules to legislate against me personally.
Yeah, well, why don't we bring that up? They changed offensive goaltending because of you. You want to explain what this is?
Yeah, well, offensive goaltending is when your opponents shoot the ball, and you are allowed to go up while they shoot the ball and maybe guide it into the basket or aid it or help it or just grab it and just throw it into the basket yourself. And they said it was unfair because I used to do that with great frequency, and the defensive player is not allowed to touch the ball once an offensive player shoots it while still going up. So it was something that I was able to do that other guys couldn't do, and, you know, and so they made rules against it. They widened what is considered the lane in which you have 3 seconds to cross. From the time I left college, they widened it so wouldn't allow me to be close to the basket. They did things like disallow you from dunking the ball, which from the foul line, they said that you had to stay behind the foul line. Before, you could put your foot across the foul line as long as the ball went into the basket before it was down on the other side of the foul line. They changed those rules. You used to be allowed to throw the ball over the backboard on out-of-bounds play, but because I could jump so high and no one could control me putting the ball in the basket from that way, they said that was illegal and made you have to pass the ball from the sides rather than over the backboards. There were a few things that they did.
Let me ask you, when regulations were changed because of what was perceived as your height advantage, how did you know that they were being changed because of you?
Well, it was quite obvious because they talked about it. And some of these things were only what I could do. We're talking about dunking from the foul line. No one else ever did it. No one else could do it at that particular time for sure. That dunking from over the backboard. I mean, I was the only guy who did it. No one else even ever tried it. So it had to be because of me.
Well, Chamberlain, when you were in the NBA, you broke the record for scoring, and one year you led the league in assists. Why did you end up switching at one point in your career from scoring to defensive?
Yeah, well, actually, you know, by leading the league in assists, it's still a part of scoring. I was asked to do some different things other than score because they felt as though I had the ability to do virtually almost anything that I wanted to do on the basketball court, and they thought it would make the team a more cohesive unit if I would maybe get them more involved and them just watching me do my thing. And they were basically right. I wonder, though, as I look back in retrospect, whether Wilt Chamberlain should have just kept on scoring along with the other things that he was doing. But it worked out well for me, and in the year that I led the league in assists, we also had a great basketball team and won the world championship.
Did you want to stop shooting yourself?
Well, I never really gave it a thought, but, you know, when you're on a team and you have your mentor and people suggest certain things to you, you try to do whatever seems to be best at the time for the particular team. You don't always maybe feel that way. I mean, as a player, there's many things they ask you to do that you feel maybe different than what you would like to do, but, you know, that's what a team's what's all about.
You had the reputation in some circles as being a, quote, selfish player. What did that mean to you, and did you think it was justified?
Well, definitely not justified. They always consider shooters and guys who score as selfish, which is one of the things I addressed in my book, that if you are able to put the ball in the basket better than someone else, why should that make you selfish? Some guys are able to pass the ball better than other people, and they are given the titles of being unselfish because they give assists. You know, some guys are great rebounders. How can I be selfish when I work so hard to get the ball? The toughest job in basketball is rebounding. I was the greatest rebounder in the history of the game. They said selfish because it's one way of demeaning what Wilt Chamberlain was all about, and these are some of the things that I address in my book.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Wilt Chamberlain, and he has a new book called A View from Above. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Wilt Chamberlain is my guest. Now, you were great at scoring with the exception of foul shots, and some people thought that was because you never practiced. In your book, you write, it's because you had a psychological block. Well, tell me what the problem was with foul shooting.
Well, if I knew what the problem really was, I wouldn't have had the problem. I was a very good foul shooter in high school. I was an adequate foul shooter in college, and as time went on, I got worse and worse. I believe the more people focused attention onto it, the more I became sort of neurotic about what I was not doing. So it was really, I believe, a psychological thing. In fact, I went to a therapist about it, you know, so, and he tried to help me out, you know, for about 2.5 months, and I came away from the therapist. The therapist ended up being a great foul shooter, and I was, you know, still the same.
So what did the therapist do to try to help you with your foul shooting?
Well, he just kind of tried to talk to me about various things that were in my life and seeing where they may have some effect of what was blocking me out when I would also see. Foul shooting is a little bit different than shooting from the field because now you're coming to at rest. Now all of a sudden you're not doing these natural things with your body and in flow of movement and so on and so forth. You have to come and stop. If you were a hard rebound and running a lot, you have to bring your body to a rest and stop it and relax it and then do something which is not exactly as natural as a basketball player. And it comes to a lot of concentration. And apparently I was losing my concentration. So he tried to find out what was making Wilt Chamberlain lose his concentration at that particular point.
What were his theories?
He didn't really have very many theories, and that's why I left him. I tried for 2 months to see if he had something that would be helpful, but it never really happened.
All right. Now, you started with the Harlem Globetrotters, and you played with them for how long?
I actually played with the Harlem Globetrotters for 17 years. I started with them my first year before I entered the NBA, and I owe a great deal to the Harlem Globetrotters. In fact, basketball in general on the pro level owes a great deal to the Harlem Globetrotters. They used to play doubleheaders in the beginning of the league when they were in financial trouble, and people would come out and watch the Globetrotters, and then some would stay to watch the second game, which would be the NBA game. The Globetrotters afforded me the opportunity as a young man of color to fulfill a dream. I used to dream it one day that I could play with the Harlem Globetrotters and see the world and make people laugh and do some of the fun things you do, but also play great basketball. So when the opportunity came for me, I was quite honored. Even at that stage in my life where some people consider me the best basketball player in the world, my dream was still to want to be a Harlem Globetrotter, not to play in the NBA. And so I got a chance to do just that.
17 years with the Globetrotters. How old were you when you joined?
Well, I started at 21, and I played, you know, right through my whole basketball career. When the season ended in NBA, I would go and join the Globies wherever they were in the world.
Oh. You retired at the age of 36, I think?
Yeah, almost 37, almost 37.
Mm-hmm. How did you choose the moment to retire?
Well, you know, that question has not been asked, and it's a great question because I went to a little island off the coast of Yugoslavia, off the coast of a little town called Split, near Yugoslavia, and a friend of mine had a home that summer, and I spent 2 weeks just thinking and getting my thoughts together and seeing where I wanted to go. My 5-year contract was up with the Los Angeles Lakers, and I had to make a decision on what I wanted to do. I just thought it was time to do something else in my life while I was still younger and healthy enough to enjoy it.
I think lots of people try to stay in as long as they can, and mm-hmm. you could have stayed longer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I you know what? I think as I look back now, Terry, that I feel as though there was something else that motivated me. My heroes were Joe Louis and Sugar Ray Robinson and Willie Mays and guys like that. And I watched them in the latter part of their careers, and they were not the great athletes that they were, and I thought maybe they stayed a little too long. And I didn't think of myself as that way. When I left the NBA, I had just broken a record for percent shooting, which may last for quite a long while. My very last year, I was still leading the league in rebounds. I was still the number one shot blocker in the league and considered the number one defensive player. So I was still at the top of not of my game, but of the game in the NBA for the players of that particular time. But I must have thought more about the fact that that's also the time that one should leave is when he's at the top.
Right. Okay, well, Chamberlain, I think it's time to talk about sex. Now, as we read your book, we learn not only about the basketball records that you broke, but it seems you've broken a couple of sexual ones as mm-hmm. well. Mm-hmm. You estimate you slept with 20,000 different women. And you average that as 1.2 a day since you were 15 years old. Mm-hmm. Who's keeping score?
Who's keeping score? Well, it sounds like that one is keeping score. Let me try to explain that to you a little bit. When, you know, if you have an involvement in life with sexual encounters, as I put it, that consume that much of your life, and you're writing a book about your life and what shapes the ideas and forms some of your opinions in life, you'd be really rather dishonest to preclude that from your book. If I told people I was a basketball player and they say, well, what did you do? Did you score points or what? And I said, yeah, I was a good scorer. Well, what does that really mean? If I tell them that I scored 100 points in one game and average 50 points a season one time, they get a better picture of what Will Chamberlain's about as a basketball player. So as I was sitting here writing my book, and I'm trying to explain these to my potential readers, well, some of the things I did off the court and how involved I was in sexual activities, I wanted to maybe keep it personal, but I also wanted to have an idea of just how involved I was. So I went back and checked, you know, some of my date books and some of my appointment books and try to remember and recollect. And I would add up, say, 1969, July, how many encounters there may have been, and, you know, and prorated by 12 and do the same thing for 74 and prorated by 12. Then take those 12s and multiply them by 40, and I come out to the number of 20,000. Now, that may sound like bragging. One was not bragging. One was trying to make a statement, in fact, to show people what I was about. A lot of this happened during the 60s and the 70s when I believe there was a sexual revolution and women wanted to sort of equate with men and have the same freedom as men did. I was young, you know, able and willing, you know what I'm saying? Luckily, I was strong. And I, you know, so I did partake. But I'm not here to promote promiscuity. I believe that this is a different era, and we must be a lot more careful about those kind of involvements, and I practice safe sex, and I just kind of believe that you have to be a lot more selective. I have a great deal of respect also for women, so it wasn't a matter of conquest. This was a mutuality thing where two minds conceived and wanted something, and the bodies did it. It was an era that happened a lot more, and I'm not ashamed of it. I'm just trying to tell people a little bit about me and what I was about.
So when did safe sex become an issue for you?
It became an issue for me when it became a noticeable socially that things could happen to you that would, eventually may kill you.
How long ago did you start thinking about this?
About 8-9 years ago, you know.
Have you ever had relations with a woman more than a couple of times?
Oh, of course I have. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, of course I have. And, you know, but I can understand you asking that. One thinks that, well, you know, you have to go boom, boom, bam. No, I have, and many of the ones that maybe only one time are now very dear friends of mine. So, you know, it isn't just the sexual, it's not all sexuality.
You know, some people would probably be really envious of your record in this area, and other people would think that you had a really serious problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard both things. First of all, I don't like to think of it as a record. It was a part of my life. But why it would be a problem for one to do what one enjoys and what really is kind of natural for a man? I don't ever deem that as a problem. I think those people have a problem, you know, addressing it. That's my opinion on that.
Are you still on a sexual binge?
I still have that sexual desire, you understand? I mean, you know, I'm forced now to control it a lot more than I once did.
Forced by what?
Forced by what's out there or what could be out there.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. In your book, you write, "I was chosen to be a man of controversy." What do you mean by that?
Well, I'm outspoken, and I think a lot of people kind of cling on what you say, you know, and not why you are really saying it. I believed strongly in situations that some people couldn't possibly see that I could possibly be involved in. I was a Nixon supporter, as a Republican, and being of color, a lot of people looked at that like you must be out of your mind. Instead, I dated interracially. A lot of people didn't like that. I spoke my mind about many different things. I was an activist, as I mentioned, you know, and so I didn't sit on the fence on most issues, and therefore that made me a controversial person. And also, misunderstood with the controversy because of size and you know, and color in the society that I grew up in. A lot of people really couldn't relate to Wilt Chamberlain.
Any regrets about being as outspoken as you've been?
None at all. I mean, you know, I haven't always said the right thing, but I've meant well about what I've said. I believe that the only way that you can bring attention and get some things done is to bring attention to those things. You know, you can do it through verbalization, which I believe is the best way than going out and hitting guys across the head or starting wars.
Well, Chamberlain, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure.
Will Chamberlain's new book is called A View from Above. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.